feel safe. Yeah, you know. Finally. Yeah, we did it.
Sleeping and the police came to me and he was saying that, hey, you guys want to go to Austria? I said, yeah.
People are coming and we give just water and some food, fruits, and we are trying to help.
Serious and big problem we have to face now in Europe, and I believe football has a kind of responsibility.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the 7th edition of the El Arpa podcast. Maria, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I'm good, thank you. So this week we are looking at something that has been in the news lately, and that topic is, Maria?
The refugee crisis.
The refugee crisis, exactly. So obviously those who are listening at home in their cars or on their phones, I'm sure you've been following this closely or not so closely in the news over the last few weeks. You probably have your own opinion. We have seen people talking very positively about it, welcoming the refugees with open arms, others a bit more critical and hesitant to do so. So, Maria, I take it you're a learned, accomplished, intelligent, educated person. You've been following the coverage, have you not?
Yeah, of course I have.
Of course you have. Okay, so there's a sense of duty there. You've been following it. You feel it's an important issue, I believe.
Yeah, of course it's an important issue. And, well, I think it was an issue already long before, the latest events, really. So
That is true, because we are looking in the second part of the show, because yesterday, listeners, we're dividing the show up by the magic of musical markers into part one and part two. And in part two, we'll be looking at football. And Buffon, another Italian footballer, said the same in a press conference. He said that the migrant problem has been something that's not a problem, but the fact of people coming in, kind of escaping worse situations and seeking a better life into more prosperous European nations is something that we've always been maybe aware of, but we haven't really spoken about. And this is kind of a watershed moment, because it has been covered quite a lot on all the social medias, and also as well in the newspapers, and between people as well talking about it. So, like, is there one characteristic from all the coverage that stands out for you? Are you happy with the coverage at large, or do you think it's taking the wrong tone, or what's your opinion about it?
Well, the thing that I found most annoying was that this was an issue that, you know, has been ongoing for years, and then obviously it's got especially worse during the summer. But then, you know, it was only when, like, we saw, like, this really tragic pictures of these kids that, you know, washed up on, like, Turkish beach, and all this, like, was really dramatic. But it was kind of like a switch. Everybody suddenly started, you know, realizing what had been going on, and it's just a bit sad that, you know, it takes something as as dramatic as that to get people to actually pay attention.
But what worries me about this is that, yes, we had this shocking image, you know, but do you think that because people's interest is only, you know, alerted by the shocking image, that it's not a deep lying interest in it, and that, you know, easy come, easy go, basically. This interest sprang out of nowhere, maybe, and can dissipate quite as quickly. Do you think that's a genuine concern?
Well, I think that's definitely the case, and it usually happens with this sort of crisis, and, you know, people are really moved by a certain image, and then, you know, slowly forget about it.
Well, I think as well the problem is, I mean, it is a very complex issue. You know, for example, you know, we saw the, you know, Syrian man who was tripped in Hungary by a reporter, and he made headlines recently because he's been moved to Spain. He's a football coach back in Syria, and now he's gotten a job, or has some kind of connection with Getafe Football Club, in Madrid. You know, but I mean, for example, you know, people are kind of contrasting the Hungarian reaction to it, and then, you know, with the German reaction to it. Well, people are forgetting now as well that Germany has closed its borders now a little bit, and the police and the soldiers are kind of controlling the influx of people more closely. And what people forget as well is that Hungary is a poor country itself. So, you know, I mean...
Well, I think there's an argument that a distinction should be made between the states and, you know, the people in them.
Yeah,
And this is something that people are trying to argue, that, you know, it hasn't been, nothing has been done until, you know, people have sort of like complained about it and have raised their concerns to their respective governments and so on.
Exactly, yeah. I think as well, you know, I mean, there has been a lot of good work done, and obviously we both support the fact that these people are being welcomed in their new countries, because they deserve to find, you know, a life in a more peaceful place, you know, because at the moment they're coming from a war-torn region. But what I'd be interested to see is how this kind of this story unfolds, like in the next 5-10 years, because right now there is a lot of goodwill, you know, but, you know, if the economy in different places keeps going down, will people resent them having houses or work? Mm. You know, I wonder how their long-term integration into these communities is going to go, but, you know, time will only tell that. Nobody can speculate about that.
Yeah.
But for the moment, I mean, they are being welcomed quite broadly, aren't they, by a lot of people?
Well, something else that I'm worried about is this idea that suddenly people, you know, like you see it when you're on the metro, for example, like, people used to like give, even in Madrid, people used to like give, I would say, sometimes suspicious looks to Arabs and so on. And now there's even like friendly faces, and everybody seems to be thinking, like, you know, are these like refugees? And, you know, as if they were like somehow,
well,
you know, more respectable, which of course they are, but so are the people that were already here, of course.
Well, like, I mean, I see your point. I think it is a defining...
Like it's some kind of hypocrisy.
It could be... Well, it could be hypocrisy, or it could be a moment where people's attitudes change, and that's what we don't know. We just have to wait for that to...
It would be fantastic if that applied to everybody else, and, you know, suddenly, like, people realize that the people that they have around them are not just, you know, immigrants, but are people like themselves.
Exactly. Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, that would be fantastic, but...
Or it could be, you know, it might be changing attitude only to a select group of people, because I think, you know, having lived in Madrid for a while, it is a fantastic place, but it does have a problem with race relations, I think, and then how it views, you know, its immigrants and its African immigrants as well, you know, so...
That's what I mean,
yeah.
Like, it's kind of like, to me, it's no use from the point of view of, like, integration and, you know, creating sort of, like... multicultural city, and, you know, with tolerance and so on, it's no use just focusing on people from a certain country and, you know,
exactly,
ignoring everybody else.
Because, you know, some of these immigrants might not be coming from a war-torn region, but poverty is another social issue that drives people to move, you know?
Yeah, this has been something, you know, very commented on TV about the difference between people that are getting away from a war zone and people that are just migrating to get a better life. But you know. Of course, there is an argument to be made that people that escape from war are protected by international law and so on.
Yeah.
And have a priority, but, you know, I think there's an argument to be made about all the factors, like what you're saying, you know, about, like, poverty and even the pressures in other countries from a country having a war, you know.
Well, exactly, yeah. But also, as well, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of movement in Europe in general. I mean, the French people are, I think, the highest concentration of people in London who are not English are French. Spanish people move quite a lot. And, of course, Irish people move quite a lot. My point is, you know, we are, you know, to some extent migrants as well because of the economy or because of seeking a better fortune, you know. But we are more protected by European Union law or you know, our base is a higher base that we're starting from than those coming from African countries, for example, that are arriving into Madrid. And, for example, I mean, this migrant crisis was starting even before Syria with people coming into Calais and the Mediterranean and these boats, you know, that...
Well, it's a problem that... Well, a problem. It's a situation that has been happening in Spain for years.
Exactly. And, you know, I think people should realize that, you know, we're not so different, really, because the same forces move us, but just to varying extents, you know. We are victims of circumstance or victims of the economy. But again, there are people who suffer from it to a greater degree than other people do, you know. Like, I am an economic migrant as well, to an extent, but a very lucky one, you know. So I think people should be aware of how vulnerable people are to circumstance. And there's people who move into their country because of circumstance, you know, who are, you know, making a great sacrifice and leaving their homeland, you know. I mean, there was a big worry when Britain temporarily allowed a lot of Romanians into the country. And they sent a news crew over to Romania, and people were like, well, we don't want to live there. I mean, we're happy to live in Romania. I mean, and then, you know, if we go there, we're there to work, you know. So there's a general fear from people that, you know, they're there to take and rob and steal, which is only put forth by, you know, people like Britain First or parties that are, you know, very anti-immigration in general. But I think the ordinary person, the person who's reading the newspaper on the metro, has to be aware that, you know, they could be forced to move to a country to better their situation. And the people that are coming from African countries are doing just the same, you know. But that's not part of the media narrative at the moment. The media narrative is these heroic people escaping a war situation, which is, you know, what they are. I mean, they are making a huge sacrifice. But it's only part of the story, you know. There are other migrants as well who could be left behind. And also, as well, the groundswell of optimism, I think, might not be... Well, hopefully it's more permanent and deeper rooted than just a superficial reaction to stuff that's happening in the newspaper. So, I don't know. Do you have anything else to add?
No, that's pretty much it.
All right, well, we're not finished there yet, though, podcast listeners, because obviously this is the El Arpa podcast. We are Madrid's number one English academy, and we are the number one teachers in that academy. So... slash the only teachers in that academy. So, like, from a teaching's perspective, do you have any experience of teaching refugees English?
Yeah, I have some experience of teaching refugees when I was living in the UK, yeah.
Okay, so can you fill us in a little bit on that?
Well, there were just some classes that, you know, were offered as part of, like, teaching practice, and people just went there and had classes for free, and for us it was very interesting. I mean, other, you know, beyond the actual practicing teaching people, they had some really fascinating stories about reasons why they were in the UK, and they were very, you know, eager to learn and eager to adapt and integrate. And
Was the dynamic of the class, was it different from like a regular class, you know, of people who are just studying for exams or for other reasons, you know? I mean, and even as a teacher teaching it, I mean, was it harder to teach? Were you teaching different things? Or was it like a normal class for you?
Well, I mean, I was teaching a different way because obviously you had to, you know, account for like many different like cultural sensitivities and so on.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, for example, the Irish government right now are focusing a lot on teaching English to Syrian refugees that they're taking in. I read a government report where they said, for example, you know, a lot of these migrants have limited time to study because they're maybe looking for work or dealing with the bureaucracy of the country. trying to get legalized or whatever else, or finding accommodation. Is there a run on from that as well? There's like a lack of energy. So, you know, I mean, most of their time is maybe spent trying to establish themselves or survive, and then English might be a secondary concern because time, it's the other things are so time consuming, and they might be so tired when they're finished doing those things.
Yeah.
And also, as well, in the classes, you can have huge differences in level. Have you experienced that?
Well, I was going to say, I kind of experienced the opposite thing, because people like were so keen on like finding work very quickly, and they knew that certain jobs they couldn't access unless they spoke some English, so they were really eager, and some of them were making, you know, a huge effort to learn English and to improve. So
okay.
Some of them, like, you know, were like working all night and basically coming straight into class. So
they really, really wanted to learn.
Yeah, they were very motivated.
Another thing they mentioned was a tip for teachers. For example, don't focus on grammar exercises. Focus on speaking. You know, because they'll be speaking a lot, and also as well focus on situations in which they'll use their English, you know, so job interviews or other kind of scenarios that they're going to be exposed to at the very start. So kind of focus in on those areas in particular. Is that a good tip?
I think that's a good tip, but obviously culture is important as a part of any other language class, but for refugees in particular, who often come from, you know, countries that are culturally far apart from European countries, I think it's particularly important to.
And they also say as well you should focus on the speaking exercises because they can tell stories about themselves, and it helps in their reinvention because they're kind of reinventing themselves in the new country, and that's something that should happen in the classroom as well.
I remember, some of them, when they were asked to like tell their experiences, or for example, you know, a moment where they were scared in their lives, and we would say something like, you know, a time when I thought I lost my wallet or something like that, and they were like, you know, telling really gruesome stories about moments where they were genuinely scared, like they fear for their lives or the lives of their family. And in that respect, it kind of helped them, you know, share it and feel better.
Okay, so it's like therapeutic almost.
In a way, I guess.
Okay, so I think the teacher in a class with such students has almost a different profile almost. You know, you're kind of helping social integration as well, not just the language integration.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think that's very important. And, you know, it's, well, for me it was a privilege to be in that position, really.
Okay, well, folks, that's the end of part one. Join us momentarily for part two. Welcome back to part two. Are you excited?
I'm very excited.
Woo! Part two. Okay, so we're talking about something connected to part one, but a little bit lighter, looking at the football aspect of this thing. So, Maria, I can tell she's wearing a Real Madrid jersey at this moment with her name on the back of it. Maria, number 10. So, are you a football fan? That's a no. Okay, so you're not a football fan. You're a fair weather fan. When there's a World Cup final in Spain around it, you'll watch the game. So that's okay. But have you also come across in your coverage a football reaction to this refugee thing at the moment? Have you come across any of that, or have you chosen to ignore it?
Oh yeah, no, I haven't chosen to ignore it. Just give as much importance as everything else.
Yes.
But no, we've seen lots of reactions, in the stadium.
It's very vague, very, very vague. Okay, so I'm going to take off the mantle here as the resident football guy. But no, it's okay. You're a basketball fan. When basketball opens its doors to refugees, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, okay. Just get on with it.
We heard two recordings of football-related people talking about the refugee crisis, and I mean I love football. You know this. I love football. Ronaldo or Messi?
Messi.
Of course, good answer. Okay, so on that we can agree. But I think one of the reasons football has been so open to it is because the roots of football are, you know, beautiful. I mean, it truly is the world game. You know, you see sports becoming more global. The Rugby World Cup is on at the moment, obviously, and it's becoming even more popular in lots of countries. But I think football is truly a global sport. And, you know, because you think of the countries where it's developed, like Brazil, how did it get there? You know, an English guy came on a boat with some footballs and it developed from that. You know, Barcelona as well were founded. It's literally like that. You're laughing. How could that happen? It's so simple. But that's what happened. You know, it's the same with Barcelona, with Gamper, Mr. Gamper, a Swiss businessman, and also an Englishman as well, who kind of helps set up the club there. So, you know, I mean, in terms of how clubs and national games developed, you know, immigrants and migrants have been a huge part of that story, you know. And ESPN wrote a great article about this as well. It said football doesn't have any political value. Not that it doesn't have any political value, but it doesn't normally mix with football. And it's true, because even Barcelona, to go back to Barcelona, are seen as a politicized club, and they're the badge of an independent Catalonia. Okay, so, but you know, but they make the point that, you know, it doesn't have a political responsibility, but it does have a social responsibility, and it's always had that social responsibility, you know. Football has been very active in different social elements, you know, in different, you know, for example, Manchester City have put a lot of money back into their local area. Barcelona, if you go to the museum and you follow the club, they talk a lot about that kind of stuff as well. And now this is the greatest kind of social issue of our time at the moment, and I think it makes sense that football, having its fine tradition of social inclusion and social work, is kind of taking up this issue in such a big way. And because football, I think, fundamentally is a grassroots game compared to other sports. I mean, baseball, you need equipment. Rugby, you need equipment. But football, you don't. Ronaldo grew up playing football, you know, with very poor resources, you know, but you're still able to do that, you know, because football fundamentally is quite a simple game. And I think, you know, what reflects that simplicity and its grassroots nature is that fact it's not just the clubs at the higher levels and the players talking about it, but it's the fans, you know, off their own back and their own initiative, bringing in flags to the stadium and helping in a more proactive way as well, in a direct way, by giving out food and supplies to those people. So I think football, more than any other sport, kind of lends itself to this kind of action. So, you know, that's why I've always loved football, and why I think I love football even more right now, you know. And it's even like in Australia, this Australian game football league is taking off right now, and the coach of the Australian national team is a son of Greek immigrants, you know. So and a lot of players in the past have been Greek or from Eastern Europe who've built that game up in that country. And again, going back to my earlier point in part one about how, you know, we're all victims of circumstance and we're all, to some extent, economic migrants, you know. You know, a lot of, like, right now, Del Piero, he was in Australia. Steven Gerrard's gone to the United States. These are immigrants who are helping to develop the game as well. And if we celebrate them, we have to remember a lot. Very often it's been the poor immigrants that we don't remember who helped build the game in the first place in those countries. So, you know, football has a lot of historical ties to immigration and to immigrants, and has benefited a lot from it. And it's nice to see football give that back, you know. I mean, that's the most important point to remember. So, you know, politicians might be just untrustworthy, but footballers are always, always right. Always.
Sure.
Always. Okay, so that's my spiel over. So any last anecdotes, jokes, tongue teasers, testers, riddles, or any last comments on this issue that we've covered in this podcast, Maria?
No.
Okay, all right, well, let's wrap it up then. So this is Enda from the Alarpa podcast. We gave you a mammoth one today. I think it's over 20 minutes now. So bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.